This podcast was produced by ORFM Dunedin with support from New Zealand On the Air.
Write On, showcasing the work and lives of Otago and Southland writers. Tune in for news and interviews with your local writers on the second Wednesday of every month from noon to 1 and repeated the following Sunday at 1 p.m. Kindly sponsored by the great team at the University Bookshop. What do you want to be when you grow up? They say you are what you read, and the University Bookshop can help you be whoever you want to be. Do you want to be an athlete? Then sit down with an inspiring sports biography. Do you fancy yourself as a detective? We have a grisly lineup of murder mysteries waiting just for you. Do you aspire to be the world's greatest chef? We have cookbooks to tantalise your taste buds. Do you want to celebrate your inner child? Play up in our fabulous children's room. The University Bookshop, helping you decide what you want to be when you grow up. Good afternoon and welcome. You're listening to Otago Access Radio and Write On with Evander Simon, which is the show of the Otago Southland branch of the New Zealand Society of Authors and sponsored by that great team at the University Bookshop. So join us for the next hour as we delve into the wonderful world of books. Now, this is actually a very special and also a rather sad show for me, as after 18 years of hosting and bringing you the Write On radio show, I'm hanging up the headphones and pushing aside the microphone and passing the baton on to someone else. So today's show will hark back to the very beginnings and also catch up with a favourite regular guest. So let's get back to the beginnings. Way back in November 2005, a very nervous myself psyched myself up to broadcast the very first Write On radio show. And I feel eternally grateful to the first three guests who were game enough to come onto the new show back then, Penelope Todd, Maxine Alterio, and Carolyn McCurdy. So it feels very apt, almost 18 years later, to have them back as guests on this, my very last Write On radio show. So Carolyn, Maxine and Penelope, welcome back to the show.
Thank you, Vanda, and congratulations.
Thank you. And of course, most of you have actually had on other episodes of the shows as you've had new books come out over the years. But what I thought I'd want to do first is just start with each of you taking you back to the past and looking at the book that we talked about in that very first show and how your writing career has moved on and what's happened in your writing career since that time. So I'm going to start with you, Penelope. And when we talked, your new young adult novel, Box, had just been released. Your eyes are widening. I was like, wow, really? It wasn't that book there. And you were at that time writing quite a lot of young adult teen quiet fiction and being very, very successful with it in that realm. So where has your writing journey taken you since that time?
Well, I think that was 2005.
Yeah.
I think that might have been the last young adult book that I wrote.
I think you had Zilla after that.
Thank you for reminding me.
I had to do my research.
Written Digging for Spain at that point?
No, you had not.
Because that was a kind of, in a way, it was a kind of summary of where the writing journey had taken me when I went to stay at on a writer's retreat in Spain. And I kind of, I thought about the big changes that writing had worked in my life, by hook or by crook. And I related also to the very present experience of being in Spain. So, and then I think I had a little bit of a hiatus, and then I published a novel for adults called Island, which may have subsided under the sea as far as its presence in the world went. After that, we all thought that digital publishing was going to create a huge wave, and I thought I would catch it with Rosemary Books, and Carolyn was actually one of the people who was very strong support as I started that up. And well, I published some beautiful books, but they likewise floated quietly. Well, they're still available, actually, but after 10 years, I just found the intricacies and the sort of urgency of publishing all those books and keeping them all afloat and all the detail involved with it just too much, and I just kind of bowed out for a while, while also doing a little bit of writing, but nothing very much.
So was there, you had very much, when I talked to you that first time, been riding the wave of young adult fiction. So was it a conscious choice to move away into other things, into writing a novel for adults, but also your memoir, as it were, the Spain journey?
It's hard to know how much is consciously chosen. I think I could note that my protagonists in the young adult novels had been growing older, mm-hmm. and probably working some things through on my behalf, for my ever present in a young people. And then, yes, in Ireland, the protagonist was probably about 20. So, yes, maybe I was growing out of it and wanting to broach some of the issues that, you know, of my more current life. And I have done that recently in a novel that it might not be the time to talk of that now.
Yeah. So, well, Maxine, we'll move on to you next. Oh, she looks startled. So way back in 2005, we were celebrating the release of your book, Live News and Other Short Stories. So did you stay just with the short fiction, or did you venture out into new realms?
Well, I love short fiction, and I would like to stay with short fiction, but publishers tend to want novels. And I did have a novel that had been sort of lurking at the back of my mind for many, many years. And eventually I did finish it. And I think it came out in 2007 with Penguin. And so that was Ribbons of Grace. And since then there have been two other novels, Lives We Leave Behind. Maybe that was 2012, and then it was published in France, 2013. And then, gosh, I can't even remember, it might have been 2019 that my latest novel came out, which was The Gulf Between, and Penguin Random House published that. So I did move into long fiction, and now I find when I start a piece of fiction and I'm certain it's going to be a short story, it just grows legs. I've sort of lost the ability to write a short story. So novels seem to be where I am now, although occasionally I do write a little bit of flash fiction, which I really enjoy. It's lovely just playing with a piece of writing that you see on one page and just, you know, finessing it. I do enjoy that.
And I recall interviewing about Ribbons of Grace when it came out, because it was a story based in Arrowtown and very, very close to so many people could relate to it. And it created quite a stir in a way. And yes, it was a big thing. So how did that feel for you, having that first fiction novel gain so much traction?
Well, I'll be forever grateful to Jeff Walker, who was at Penguin at that stage, because he and his team did a mighty publicity campaign. I've never had the same kind of publicity since then. I mean, Jeff even had toilet doors in Auckland airport covered, you know, imprinted with text and so forth. It was just superb. And I still really love that book, and readers seem to love it too, because it's still selling quite a lot here and in Australia, and it's the book that I get most attention from, and most, you know, letters and emails and people asking me to go and talk about it. And so I think it's something to do with the history of an area that we all love, and memories of those days that were so hard for the Chinese gold miners. And so it just seemed to be the right book at the right time, and I think that's absolute luck.
Happy luck.
Very happy luck, yes.
So, Carolyn, when we were first talked back in 2005, the focus for our conversation was very much on your poetry at that stage, shortly after you had a short story collection published as well. But poetry then, how has your writing stayed with the poetry and the short fiction? Or did you do a little foray elsewhere as well?
A lot of my writing sort of fits and starts. So I was a very new poet at that point, very unconfident, just a novice. And that has done quite well. So I had a collection published in 2015, Bones in the Octagon, and am working on a and hopefully another one. But yeah, I tried various things. I had been writing short stories, and standard publishers were not interested. But as Maxine says, they want novels. So I was finding it hard going. And then Penelope has influenced my writing in lots of ways that she probably doesn't suspect. She seemed to be having a good time with her writing. And I thought, God, this is really, really what I need. So I went to children's fiction and certainly did have a much better time and found a publisher. And yeah, and also the short stories I did have published were in an e-book published by Penelope. So, yeah.
That's what I love about the fact that you three ladies were the first three people who were game enough and actually said yes, particularly you, Carolyn, because, again, like you said, you were quite nervous and quite a new poet at that stage, but that you've sort of kept this working collaboration up over the years, and that you were, you know, had the grass is greener on the young adult fiction side of the hill, because one of the books I really enjoyed interviewing you about was The Unquiet, which was your children's sort of like sci-fi fantasy book. And what I loved most about that book was that you had tied up our Maori mythology into a fantasy realm. I mean, how did you come up with that concept?
By accident. Really, I hadn't thought it through, and there are some things I regret about that, really. There's a kind of cultural appropriation thing that I think I absolutely did. It was 2006 that it was published, and I was aware of that to a degree, but not to the degree that I think we're all aware of it these days. So I had my children go following a fairly standard magical trail that they went underground. They were going to be finding something amazing to save the world. And then I thought, well, this is underground in New Zealand. What would they find? They would find bones. And then I thought, who would they be? And it just popped into my head that they would be, this was Maui. And it just carried on. It developed a momentum of its own. I almost felt as if as if Mo is there saying, I'm in this, because I had to rewrite it to accommodate him. But then he's a trickster. I did feel there was a sort of trickster element going on that I was unaware of at the time, but I feel it now.
Because I know it was sort of at the time, and like you say, often writing is of a time. That was quite a new concept for New Zealand young readers to actually read about our cultural history, you know, tied up into fantasy, so it was very, very cool. So for each of you, looking back, how did your journey differ from what you had maybe planned or imagined? Yeah, and we'll start with you this time, Maxine.
Well, I don't know that I'd planned anything. I just want to get a book published, and that was the first thing. And so my collection of short stories was published, and then I finished the novel, and I thought, oh, well, I'll send it to both Random House and Penguin, and, you know, I probably won't ever hear back. But within 48 hours, I had a contract from both.
And that's astonishing.
I don't think that would happen nowadays. And so, you know, I had a real dilemma, and Penguin flew me up and wined and dined me and, you know, did wonderful sort of conversations and took me into the boardroom, and all the managers told me what they could do for me in my book. And I think that was the highlight of my career.
They fought over you. They fought over you.
I think it's just that feeling that when you don't really know what you're letting yourself in for, and it seems amazing, but it doesn't always carry on like that, Vanda, as we all know. So I often think about that time and just think, my goodness, you know, that was just remarkable. But I didn't realise it at the time, but I think both Penguin and Random were looking for that type of book about the Chinese set in New Zealand, and I was just really fortunate. And I don't think you can always pick that, but at that board meeting, Jeff said to me, do you have another book in you? And I thought, no, but that's an important question. So I said, yes.
Of course you did.
And he said, well, tell us about it. And into my mind popped a story that a nurse historian friend had shared with me about the hospital ship Marquette going down in the Aegean Sea in the First World War. And so I just started talking about that as though, you know, I was really au fait and that was my intention. And I walked away from that meeting having signed a two-book deal. And, you know, really, that was remarkable.
So now you had to write it.
So I had to write a book that I hadn't intended even thinking about. But it was a, you know, it was an honour to actually do that research, and it was part of my, it ended up being part of a PhD through Vic, and so it was a really enjoyable experience, and it was wonderful when Penguin had it picked up in France. So another really good luck story for me. I feel very fortunate.
So Penelope, for you, did luck and timing have an element of it, or did you have a master plan?
No master plan, and I wonder if that's a mark of writers generally, that you just get immersed in whatever it is that seems to want to be written. And for me, I think when I first began to write, I found it such an exciting process and such a sort of a grounding, and actually this is my life, this is something only I can do. And so there's that excitement that kind of drew you on. So I didn't really have a plan about where I'd go, and I found something that worked for me, which initially was young adult writing. And then as other job opportunities sort of went by the board, I thought, well, how am I going to make a living from writing? So as many writers do, you start living off one another, and I began editing and found I was reasonably good at that. So made a little bit of a sort of a half career of that. And then, in publishing, I think, you know, we want to be of service to other writers as well and our community. So that's where I went in publishing. And I feel now that I'm sort of coming back to what is the bedrock of this career path, if you like, which is the writing. And I've been working on fiction again, and the longer fiction, I find that's probably my place, is just the slow plod or slog or whatever it is through a novel-sized piece of writing. And yeah.
Mm. And what about for you, Carolyn? Were you drifting along and going with the flow, or did you sort of have a vision?
Oh, no vision whatsoever. I was a late starter, so I didn't begin writing at all until my mid-40s, and poetry didn't begin until I was in my early 50s. So I just found it an amazing, I just couldn't believe my luck to find this thing that I loved doing, but that it would go anywhere in particular didn't really cross my mind, except for being immersed in whatever it was I was working on at the time. But I honestly do think that for a late starter, I think there's a huge confidence lack, because for most of your life you haven't been a writer. So that seems, to accept the fact that you are a writer takes quite a lot. But luckily, very luckily for me, I've been a member of several great writers' groups, and they, with both Penelope and Maxine, and for that you've got to turn up with work, and it's got to be, you know, of a standard that's not going to embarrass you. So that has kind of, and they are constructive, they help teach and encourage. So without them, I don't know that I would have had the confidence to keep going. So I have kept going, and you know, it's an important part of who I am.
Yeah. I think our writing group has been crucial to all of us, really, because we celebrate each other's successes and we commiserate when things don't go to plan. And we've all become good friends and supportive of one another when work comes out. And, for example, some of members of our writing group are going to work with Eva Ning, who is also a member, and Eva now lives in Gibston. But with her family, we're going to go through her short stories with her, and hopefully there'll be a publication later in the year or early next year. And so that's one of the joys of the writing group, I think, to work with one another, to support each other, to come to the point where we can actually send that book off to a publisher with a manuscript.
Mm.
And I think that's one of the things that's come through even just in this wee talk today, is that, you know, as a writing community, you all support each other and your endeavours in whatever way you can. And sometimes even, like in your case, Penelope, start a whole new endeavour so that you can try and help support your writer friends. And it's lovely to hear about that project, because one of the things I did want to mention was one of the cool projects that Maxine and Carolyn, in particular, you undertook in collaboration with others, and that was producing Elizabeth Brooke Carr's book of poetry, The Late Elizabeth, who was a wonderful writer and a friend. She was the one who made me do my PhD and kept on giving me little prods to, you can do this, Vanda, come on, do this. So her work, you know, wanting to tell you everything, the poems of Elizabeth Brooke Carr. So what was it like, you know, working on such a project as that?
It was a wee bit stressful in terms of timing, because Elizabeth was dying and we very much wanted to get the book together so she could hold it. And we didn't quite get to that point, but Claire Bainon, who's also in our group, she made a copy and hand-sewed it together and took it to Elizabeth just a few days before she died. And so she was able to have a feel of, you know, not quite what it would look like, but similar. And so in terms of, we all loved Elizabeth very much. She was a wonderful member of our group, and we just really wanted to see her work come out, because we thought her poetry was beautiful, and we'd listened to her read it in the group and just admired her poetry so much. Mm.
Yeah, it was a privilege to be part of it, really, and the end result was really a lovely book of Claire did a magnificent job on the cover. Mm. We had an amazing launch that was very emotional on what would have been, I think, Elizabeth's 80th birthday had she survived. So it was a huge undertaking. Really great thing to be part of.
And like you say, very touching to be able to, for you to be able to do that for someone who touched so many hearts in so many ways.
Yeah. And we all, I think most of us read one of her poems from that collection on that evening. So that was very special too.
Yes.
Yeah. So, what writing projects are you currently working on? And I'll get you to start, Penelope, because it's lovely for me to hear that you are working on a, because you know, it seems you've taken this hiatus off to help everyone else with their work, but weren't really getting an opportunity to do your own. So what project are you working on at present?
Yeah, I'm not sure if it's fair to say I was just helping other people, but anyway, well, I've got a novel that will be published in March next year with Cloud Ink Press. And in a collaborative approach, which is kind of what we almost expect these days with the publishing changes. And it's actually, I have been immersed, in fact, in elder care of my aunts. And their mother, my grandmother and my father's mother, lived both in the Mackenzie country as a young person, and then in the Maniatoto. And I've written a novel in 70 episodes of her life. So based on anecdote and impressions and not a great personal knowledge of her, but that will be Cornell, and it's exciting to have a book coming out again after maybe 14 years.
Gosh, a wee time between innings, mind you, I can't talk, probably mean about me too. What about yourself, Carolyn?
For many years I've been involved in a young adult science fiction novel. I have finished it many times and then decided no, not quite right. So that's kind of where I finished it at the end of last year. A very good writing friend looked at it and thought it needed to be restructured a little. So I began that and then thought, no, I actually really need a break. I've been years and years on this novel, so it's I've given myself permission to park it. I will go back to it. It won't go away. But in the meantime, taking a break from it, and I'm just focusing on the poetry. I'd love to get a second collection finished, so I'm probably about halfway there, and I'm just really enjoying the poetry. It's coming along well. Slowly, everything I do is slow, but it's I'm having a really good time with it.
And that's a lovely lesson in that it is actually okay just to set things aside if they're not working for you.
Yes, it's taken me a while to learn that. I've found that my focus wasn't whatever one I was working on. I was anxious about the other one, feeling guilty that I wasn't. And so finally I have noticed myself doing that and have stopped. And so my focus on the poetry is great, because I'm not worried about the novel.
Writer's guilt is real, people. And what about yourself, Maxine?
Well, I've just finished the first really rough draft of a new novel. It was supposed to be a short story, and I started it when I was doing the Dan Devon, Dan Devon Literary...
they called it the Fellowship.
Residency, that's right, down in Invercargill with Magella Cullinane. And it just sort of happened one day, and I started to, you know, make notes and write. And I thought, yes, and we were supposed to write short stories, so I thought I was doing as we'd been asked. But over the years since, it's become a novel. And I can't say too much, really, because it's only first draft and it may change. But at the moment, it's exploring the long-term impact of a traumatic event on two young teenagers and looking at how it affects their life into mid-adulthood. And set in New Zealand and also Canada, mostly in sort of a forested area that I was lucky enough to spend a summer kayaking and or canoeing, as they call it, and I was going to say tramping, but they call it hiking, in that area. And I think it was the landscape that drew me to want to write about it. And I think for me, landscape's always very important. I feel a real connection with the Central Otago landscape, but also with this part of Ontario. So it's been a pleasure to revisit memories and also read up about the area and find out things I didn't know. And I think that's one of the things I love about writing. You learn. I love learning. And so there's not a book that I've written that I haven't done a lot of research for, and I could stay just researching forever. So for me, it's quite a pull to go back and start actually writing.
Yes, the research rabbit hole.
Yeah. But it'll take a couple of years for me to be happy with it, to send it out.
Well, I thought to finish up, it would be really nice for each of you if you could, you know, I'll ask you, sort of what message or advice would you give to people who are embarking on their own writing journey, whether it's early in life or later in life, like yourself, Carolyn. We'll start with you, Carolyn.
Well, it's probably repeated it over and over again, but the most useful I've ever heard is just read, 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 write, write, write. Read what you love, read who you admire. And especially, I'm very careful about who I read. People talk about, you know, having a book take for the summer and it doesn't matter what it is. For me, it matters because I absorb language, I absorb ways of writing, which feeds my writing, and I don't want to absorb anything that I don't admire. So I read a lot and I'm careful who I read. I don't write as much. I have to make myself begin. Once I'm beginning, I'm okay. But I think that's because of being a late starter, but you have to write a lot. You know, something that you don't practice, you're not going to get any better at. So that's crucial.
And Penelope?
I absolutely endorse what Carolyn said. And I think just do it is quite helpful advice. And trust the inclination to write, because it doesn't come from nowhere. It's you're going to bear your stamp, your unique stamp. Just don't be too precious about the first draft. Just get on with it.
Yeah. Maxine?
I'd agree with both those things. I definitely think you have to be a reader in order to be a writer. And for me, I just like to focus on the writing. I'm happiest when I'm just me and my computer, quiet writing. And I try not to think about down the track when you start sending out your work, because I think that's when doubt and concerns come in. So I try to stay very focused on the work I'm doing, and I get pleasure from writing. And I think mixing with other writers too, and learning that there is... you know, very few writers have a smooth trajectory. There are lots of potholes, even more than what's on the New Zealand roads at present. And we all fumble and fall in and take little detours and feel rejected and feel excited about the thought of finishing a project. So it's a wonderful sort of roundabout of emotions, but for me, just writing. And so if people say, you know, I haven't got time to write, I think, well, if you really wanted to write, you would find the time, because I worked full-time for 40 years and wrote around the edges from the age of about 46, just weekends and evenings, a couple of evenings a week. So I don't think you should wait for the perfect time. There's never a perfect time. Just get on with it.
That's great. Look, well, thank you so much, Carolyn, Maxine and Penelope, for firstly for joining me on that very, very first show when we were all very brave sitting in this very studio and feeling extraordinarily nervous, and for coming back today and sharing this last show with me. It's been very, very special and it's been an absolute pleasure.
Well, can we say that we really appreciate the fact that you have interviewed us many times over the years too, Vanda. Mm. You've given a lot out and you know, you raised writers' profile, so thank you.
Yeah, your support of other writers is just wonderful. We are all very grateful to you.
Thank you.
So, yeah, thank you, Vanda.
We're going to take a short music break and we'll be back soon.
Into the deep blue sky. When I think of home, I sadly sigh. Oh, I can see you there with loving tears in your eyes as we fondly said our last goodbye. Stay. I promise to be true and to love only you. Blue smoke goes drifting by into the deep blue skies. My memories of home will never die.
Do you want to be when you grow up? They say you are what you read, and the university bookshop can help you be whoever you want to be. Do you want to be an athlete? Then sit down with an inspiring sports biography. Do you fancy yourself as a detective? We have a grisly lineup of murder mysteries waiting just for you. Do you aspire to be the world's greatest chef? We have cookbooks to tantalize your taste buds. Do you want to celebrate your inner child? Play up in our fabulous children's room. The University Bookshop, helping you decide what you want to be when you grow up. Welcome back. You're listening to Otago Access Radio and Right On with Vanda Simon, the show, the Otago Southland branch of the New Zealand Society of Authors and sponsored by the great team at the University Bookshop. I'm having a chuckle to myself because this is actually my last show for the, after 18 years, and I thought it particularly perfect that I completely messed up the music selection, as I have done most week, and that was not the track I intended to play. I intended to play Crowded House's The Weather With You because that seemed really appropriate, so I thought it was quite amusing that I did manage to play the wrong music track. Anyway, again, as a nod to all the years that I've been doing this show, I thought that my next guest would be most appropriate to get my most regular person on the show over the years. So Bronwyn Wiley-Gibb was the book buyer at the University Bookshop and has been my most regular guest on the Write On Show, where we've often caught up just for a good old book chat about what we've read and what we're looking forward to. So it just seemed perfect to have her as my last guest for the show. So, Bronwyn, welcome, my friend.
Oh, kia ora, how are you?
I'm good. So, let's talk books, because I know you're like myself, just an avid reader and just live in that wonderful world of books. What have you been reading and enjoying lately?
Well, there's been a couple of non-fiction titles that I've been really enjoying. Victoria Finlay is one of my favourite non-fiction writers. She wrote a book called Colour, Travels Through the Paint Box, and followed it up with a book called Buried Treasure, Travels Through the Jewel Box. And Buried Treasure is sometimes called Jewels. I think the American version is called Jewels. And they're books about their history, science, anthropology, and travel about particular subjects. So, like in Colour, she goes to Afghanistan and sees where lapis lazuli is mined, because she's talking about the very first paint boxes that people put together. And so she chases down the different colours that are in the paint boxes, and they're just fascinating and they're really interesting. And she's the one that I've, and I own those because I actually reread them every few years because they're so good, and I'm always loaning them to people. And she's just released, was it late last year or early this year, a book called Fabric, The Hidden History of the Material World.
I've seen that on the shelves and I was thinking I need to buy that book.
It is so good.
Okay, I'm definitely going to buy
it. It is
this
so
book.
Good. And she goes and spends time in Papua New Guinea with people making bark cloth. And she makes real connections with people where the places she goes. And she looks at how cotton is made, and they're just fascinating because it's about her travel, it's about what she's thinking about, but it's also the history of the particular type of material, and she looks at the science, and they're just fascinating, that whole sort of narrative nonfiction, which we've all grown to love over the last 20-25 years, that has become a real thing. Yes. In particular, she wrote about silk, and she was writing about silk, and she writes about when she first sees the silk moth, which she falls in love with, and she describes it as a cross between an angora rabbit and an angel. And I googled it, as you do, and I fell in love with the silk moth. It is so beautiful. It's like a flying baby seal is the only way I can describe
it. See, I've never seen a picture of it.
No.
And I'm going to have to go and Google it.
No,
now.
It's this fluffy white thing with, I don't think it's got eyes. I think the black bits that you think of as eyes are something to do with the antenna and something. But yeah, it's fascinating. And that was one of the really interesting things, to be reading Fabric now and having on my smartphone access to Google, and I could look up more information and more pictures. And I remember when I first read Colour, which I think only came out, was it either the very early 2000s or even the late 99, I'm sorry, I can't remember when it was, but that wasn't something you could do. You couldn't look up and have a look and see more information about something you were interested in. So I found that really interesting to do. And I did that as well with the other non-fiction book I've been reading, which is called Lapidarium, The Secret Lives of Stones, by a woman called Hetty Judah. And it's the same thing, art, myth, geology, philosophy and power. And there's about 60 stones, from diamonds to marble to granite to schist to, I don't know, any sort of stone you can think of, and two or three pages on each one. And just fascinating, as I said, the social history, the information about this amazing stuff called Pelé's hair, which I was like, what is this?
And the soccer player?
No, it's because so much work has been done and was very first done in the scientific investigation of volcanoes and volcanology was done in Hawaii, yeah, because it was accessible and things could be observed relatively safely and things like that. A lot of terms, official terms for things in volcanology, are Hawaiian. Mm. And so Pele's hair refers to a stone, a type of stone, which is basically when eruptions happen and big gobbets of things, lava and stuff and stones spit out of volcanoes. Pele's hair is the fine, fine threads that follow on, if you can imagine.
Kind of like the candy floss of the stone world.
Exactly. And it's all on the ground and it looks like hair and you want to touch it, but of course you can't because basically it's fiberglass. Mm-hmm. So it's you know how if you always want to touch pink bats, yeah, and when you're a kid and everybody says, don't touch the pink bats because of the fiberglass. And it's that, and people want to touch it because it looks like long skeins of hair lying on the ground. Mm-hmm. And that was just one of the things I discovered, and I'm completely uninterested in stone, but yet who knew all these different things and explaining how they're used. And you know, in the granite she talks about it being used in people's kitchens in the United States. And yeah, it's absolutely fascinating. And I knew it would be good because I like that sort of book where, as I say, that narrative nonfiction and lots of information. Yeah, so that's been my non-fiction reading.
Yes, and I should probably state, and mind you, listeners over the years will have already figured this out, that whenever Bronwyn tells me about these amazing books, I have this little habit of going down and buying them because she's a bad influence and an enabler when it comes to books.
Well, the fabric is there, and from what I remember at the bookshop, Colour and Buried Treasure were both books that we were still had on the shelves and were still selling, but I can let you borrow mine if you'd like.
Well, speaking of nonfiction, I always tend to have a nonfiction book on the go and a fiction book on the go simultaneously. And one of the nonfiction books that I have just completed recently, which I just absolutely adored, and it's more a memoir, is Stanley Tucci, who is his book Taste, My Life Through Food. So Stanley Tucci is an American actor. You're familiar with him from wonderful things like Julie and Julia and The Devil Wears Prada. Mm. He's been in so many.
And he wrote and performed in that amazing movie Big Night, mm, about the restaurateurs.
Yeah. Yes, yeah, yeah. And so it was just one of those heartwarming books where his just seeing his life basically through the lens of food.
He was one of those stars of lockdown, wasn't he? Where he would make, I don't know whether it was every day, but once a week or at least, he would be on social media and he'd be making cocktails.
Yeah, that's
right. And people would watch it and follow along. And yeah, and yeah, just wonderful.
Yeah. And so he's got this beautiful, beautiful family history of food and all the Italian food. And not only get the story of his memoir, because you know, he's a wonderful, lyrical, warm-hearted and actually really generous writer, mm, in what he puts in there, but it also appealed to, you know, he's just salivating, just thinking about the importance of food in the social context and how vital it was and, you know, getting people around the table, you know, talking about lockdown.
Yes.
And how important it was and just helping with everyone's well-being. And you can just sort of see over the what he learned and got from his mother and grandmother and, you know, passing on to others. Mm. So just, yeah, one of those books that I just didn't want it to finish. The other part about this book too is that, and I hadn't actually been aware, that he had a battle with cancer as well, mm, and how for him, someone who
food is everything, to have this form of cancer where he lost his sense of taste and smell and, you know, wasn't able to eat in the way that he could, and how impactful that was on him too. So it was, it's just one of those really, really warm and poignant books that I will probably actually read again. And I am definitely going to try some of the recipes. So the book comes with the recipes and some of his commentaries about, you know, the ingredients, you know, like talking about garlic. So, you know, it's got a beep load of garlic in it. You know, he's quite irreverent, shall we say, with his descriptions on how to prepare them. It's not like a formal cookbook would be.
Yeah.
I spent quite a lot of my time laughing.
Great. It sounds. That's on my list as well. Yeah.
We'll definitely bump it up the list.
Okay. I'll swap you one of my books for one of your books.
That sounds like a very fair arrangement.
Yeah.
And the other non-fiction book that I had been reading again, because I'm like yourself, I really enjoy really well-told creative non-fiction type work. It's by a man named David Barry called Incredible Journeys, Exploring Wonders of the Animal Navigation.
Right.
And so fascinating, just going through some of the theories and ideas behind the mechanisms of how some of these animals, birds, fish, insects, manage to do such incredibly long migrations, or even the shorter migrations, you know, how bees do it, and whether they're using like visual cues or magnetic cues, or like in the case of bees that we're familiar with, the dance cues.
Yes.
I'm sitting here doing like boogie dancing. The studio, you'll be glad you can't
see where you're staying, you're going. Yes,
So, and sort of there, tying in just the really the complexities of how animals navigate, including humans.
That sounds amazing. Because, and I find that really interesting, because a number of those animals are making the journey for the first time, but they know where to go. How does that work?
Yeah. And some of the interesting experiments that they did, precisely that, you know, first time navigators versus animals that were several years older and had done their navigations more time than once, and, you know, how they could confuse them.
Do they talk about the birds that, is it godwits that come here from Alaska?
Yeah.
I mean, that just seems...
That vast distance.
That just seems... Surely there are beaches in between.
Mm, yeah. And the other really interesting thing is it talks about the impact that mankind has had on animal navigation, particularly with the light pollution and noise pollution, and how that is actually disrupting
animal navigation. I read about that in something where they were talking about they turn off the big beam of light that comes out of the Empire State Building when the birds are navigating up that east coast from South America, or going the other way coming down from Canada to South America, because the birds get completely enticed by this beam of light.
So it was sort of turned into being, you know, quite a statement, also about what we are doing to the environment and the impacts that we don't even really think about with all of these things. So, yeah, that's another one. So what have you been reading in the fiction realm, my friend?
Well, I discovered several months ago at the library, I've been enjoying just mucking about at the library and finding things on the shelf, Christopher Fowler, who wrote over 50 books. He died in, I think, March this year. He wrote one of my favourite non-fiction books, which is The Book of Forgotten Authors, which is just...
a great title.
It is just wonderful. And it is about authors who the world has forgotten, and they were huge in their time. And he writes these amazing little essays about them. And I did follow up a number of them because they just sounded so good. But he wrote this series, and I think there must be 15 or 20 books, I haven't worked out for sure, about Bryant and May and their crime novels. And they're set, their novels and short, and some two or three of them are books of short stories. And Bryant and May are the two main detectives. And they work in the Met Police Officers' Peculiar Crimes Unit in London. And the Peculiar Crimes Unit, it was started during just before and during the Second World War, and it's to deal with crimes that might impact British society if they go unsolved. So it's peculiar in the sense of particular.
Yeah, rather than odd.
Yeah, although they are pretty odd. and so Bryant and May are the detectives, and I think in the last one they're in their early 80s, they're still working. Going. And the Peculiar Crimes Unit is always having to fight its corner because the main Met police aren't keen on them. And then they have various people working for them who are unusual. And they're clever and erudite and funny, and they're stuffed full with amazing true facts about London. Mm. So everything that he says about London is true in them, and so these two are out walking around, and they talk about the things that have happened in history in a particular street that they're walking down, or a road that they're walking down, or a pub that they go into, and it's utterly fascinating. And the crime angles are not bad either, and he describes them as golden age detectives in a modern day, and they're fascinating. And I looked at them and thought I don't think they're huge. I don't think they're well known in New Zealand.
I'd heard of the characters, but I wasn't familiar with the actual author's name.
That's who they are, and it's really clever, and they're just fascinating. And they're fascinating. I found the crime aspect fascinating. I thought the characters were fascinating, and the stuff about London was amazing because, in a weird sort of way, it ties into what we've been talking about, these narrative non-fiction writers who have all this little bits of information which they pull together and make something fascinating out of it. And like in one of the novels, somebody is killed in a particular apartment, and everybody thinks it's just a normal death, but Bryant and May are a bit suspicious about it because of the job that this woman used to do in public service. And then they start thinking about, and then there's a body that is found on the Thames embankment where somebody has been tied up and drowned. And then there's all the talk, and it's across from where this woman would have seen what went on. So there's that going on, and then you get all this information about things that have happened like that on the Thames Embankment over the years.
Yeah, that would be quite fascinating.
Yeah.
I think I've got time to sort of talk to one little more book, and I'm just going to quickly have a wee word about The Axeman's Carnival, which by Catherine Chidgey, and this is the book that won the Jan Medlicott Prize for the New Zealand Book Awards this year, and it's sort of been talked up and praised a lot. And I absolutely loved it. So the unique thing about The Axeman's Carnival is that it is told from the perspective of Tama, who is a magpie. Oh. And when I first heard of this whole concept or idea, I thought, that could get a bit gimmicky, couldn't it? Mm. But no, it is just absolutely perfect. The voice that she has with this bird, and just how it observes and sees this world. So, and you've read this too.
Yes. Yeah. And when an animal character is done well, it's spectacular, and it's wonderful. And somebody told me, and I haven't looked myself, but the magpie is on Twitter.
Yes. Oh, I follow Tama on Twitter.
Yeah. Which I think
is brilliant.
Tama has very good opinions, I believe.
Very strong opinions.
Yeah.
Very, very strong opinions, and quite a cutting sense of humour.
Yeah. Love it. And what I liked about it was, you know from reading the back of the book, you know that there's really, there's trouble coming in this story, that he's observing this relationship between the woman who's adopted him and picked him up when he was a baby, and the person she lives with, and you know that trouble is coming, and Tama is aware that trouble is coming. And I thought that sense was built up really, really well. And I also like Tama's interactions with his bird family, because they are still around. And they, you hear their voices as well, and their voices, for want of a better word, are birdie.
Yes,
they have birdie thoughts, and they're sounds. Screeching birdie things, and I found that amazing because, and it made me think about when. Where I went to high school in Porirua, there was a big stand of macrocarpas, and there were magpies that lived in there, and there were certain times of year it was really scary to go past, because they were out there defending from us who were paying no attention because we were far more interested in each other and what we were doing.
But yes, it's such a great book. So,
yes,
I loved it. Loved it. Well, that is our show for this month, and for me,
end of an era.
Signing off the end of an era. So I am passing the baton onto the wonderful hands of Beverly Martins, who will bring you chat and conversations from this world of books. But from me, I have to say, well, a huge thank you to our sponsor, University Bookshop, where I spend way too much of my own money, and I'll probably be charging down there to spend more today. Also a huge thank you too, and I'll miss you, to the Otago Access Radio crew. They're absolutely awesome. So, you know, it's been an amazing experience and hosting the show, and I've met some of the coolest people along the way. So bye bye for now, everyone. Ka kite.
This podcast was produced by ORFM Dunedin with support from New Zealand On the Air.